urgent calls for the government to develop a national vaccine strategy and for someone to lead it, as fears mount that New Zealand could be at the back of the queue for any potential COVID-19 vaccine. Most infectious disease experts agree any COVID-19 vaccine is at best 12 to 18 months away, and if not developed here, it could take much longer for New Zealand to get it. Currently, around 40 teams of scientists around the world are working on coronavirus vaccines. But it's complicated. Around 80 are in early stage development. There are at least five methods, different technologies to work with, from tried and tested inactivated methods, as is used for seasonal influenza, to genetic or RNA vaccines, so new that none exist yet. It all takes time. There's a six-phase process to go through, including trials to determine dosage, formulation, side effects, adverse effects, and overall effectiveness. Add to that that no human had ever encountered it before December 2019, so no one has any COVID-19 reference material, and we don't have vaccines against any coronavirus yet. The stakes couldn't be higher. In a moment, we'll talk to two New Zealand scientists and a doctor about their fears for this country specifically. But first, our guest is Ian Fraser from the University of Queensland, who co-developed the HPV vaccine Gardasil. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Good morning, Catherine.
We have talked about the difficulties of developing a vaccine from a standing start. In your opinion, if using these rapid vaccine development technologies, how realistic that the process could be condensed down to 12 to 18 months?
Look, I think there's every chance now that there are several vaccines in first-stage clinical trial that we could get one of those out in 12 to 18 months, assuming that it's effective. The results from animal studies are very encouraging overnight. We've heard about studies in monkeys that have been protected effectively against the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 and were challenged with large doses of the virus. So it's beginning to look like we might actually get a vaccine. And if we could, then 12 to 18 months is very realistic.
Coronaviruses have historically been hard to make safe vaccines for. What is it about their characteristics?
Almost everything except that they're genetically stable, which is a good thing. Now, the problem with coronaviruses is where they infect. It's on the surface of your lung to start with, and it's a difficult place to get good immunity to protect you from getting the virus into your system. The second problem is that the coronaviruses are enveloped viruses. That means that they have a sort of fatty coat on the outside, which means that any bits on the outside that we might want to make a vaccine against will only look the right shape if they're inside a fatty coat. And therefore, that makes the technical parts of making a vaccine much harder.
Your prediction is that the most likely candidate will be a vaccine that uses a part of the virus attached to a chemical to induce an immune response or a subunit vaccine. How long would
That's
it take?
That's the ones that are easiest.
Sure.
And they're the ones that are easiest to manufacture, so that I think we should be able to get one of those relatively quickly. The proteins that could be the basis of those vaccines are already being made, and we know we can make them to look the right shape and size. The critical issue with all of the vaccines is to demonstrate safety. And safety is something that can really only be done through clinical trials, and they, of course, take time.
The safety, does this pertain particularly to whether the immune response induced becomes uncontrollable in effect or does more harm than good? Could you explain more?
Well, there is a track history for coronavirus vaccines that some of them have been tested in animals and shown that if the animal is then subsequently challenged with the virus, it gets sicker than it would have done if the vaccine hadn't been given. We don't quite understand why that happens, but it's been reproduced more than once now. So that makes it extremely important that we check very carefully in animals about the safety of the vaccine and whether it could possibly be a vaccine that induces the wrong sort of immune response and makes it harder for our body to get over it rather than easier.
As we said, many groups chasing this now. Most are still in the preclinical phase, although some in in the WHO document are in phase one trials. Please explain what happens each step of the way from here.
A phase one trial is basically to see if we can get an immune response in a normal volunteer, and a small number of healthy people would be given the vaccine, and then what's in their blood would be measured afterwards. This would copy what has already been done for the vaccine in animals and make sure that the same sort of response occurs. There would be no challenge in these trials. The vaccine would not be tested. It would just merely be given as a check of safety. If the results from that were okay, the next step would be move on to a much larger study with, again, normal volunteers. And the aim there would be to try and demonstrate that the vaccine actually worked to protect against infection. That becomes challenging because, obviously, most people will go out of their way to avoid getting the infection. And we know how to do that quite effectively through social distancing. So it might even rely on people being willing to volunteer, first of all, to have the vaccine and then to be deliberately challenged with the virus in order to find out whether the vaccine is effective. Presuming that one way or another a study can be done that's big enough to show protection, and it might involve a couple of hundred or a thousand people if we had to wait for a natural infection, but maybe only 10 to 20 if the individuals would be prepared to be challenged with the virus. And then the next step after that would be big field studies, which could be done in parallel with vaccination, basically, the phase three studies, and actually going out and vaccinating at-risk people, for example, doctors and nurses working with patients, could be done in parallel.
Scientists at Oxford University's Jenner Institute say they've scheduled tests of their new coronavirus vaccine involving more than 6,000 people by the end of next month. They say the first few million doses of their vaccine could be available by September. How hopeful are you on that?
Well, look, again, if their technology is a new one, it's called it's a virus itself that they use to deliver the vaccine. And we don't actually have any vaccines licensed for use with that technology at the moment. But if it worked, then technically, yes, they could get that many doses of vaccine out by September, because when they were trying to get a vaccine against another virus infection in the past, they actually got to the stage where they could produce a million doses of vaccine in that period of time. That vaccine never got used, but it was shown effective in the animal studies, and they went on to scale up to make a large number of virus doses, large number of vaccine doses in the course of about 6 months.
Could we then talk about what happens with getting a vaccine produced, scaled up and produced and distributed? Because this is what seems particularly challenging with the way the privatised system works. Everyone from German Chancellor Angela Merkel down has been saying we need a new approach. We need a new global cooperative approach if we're to do this and do this fairly. How do you see it?
Yeah, last night I was on a teleconference with the Global Alliance for Vaccine Initiative, Gavi, and they also feel very strongly that a united approach across the world is the most appropriate way to deliver this vaccine. It would be very unfortunate if vaccine were only available in a limited number of countries that were actually making it for themselves. And it's worth pointing out, of course, that you never know what's going to be happening to your neighbours next door. It's really important to make sure that everybody gets access to the vaccine to keep the infection under control. So I think a global effort will be required. But the biggest challenge actually is scaling up any vaccine that we do discover will work to the level will be necessary to deliver a vaccine to a population of 8 billion people across the planet.
We spoke to Johnson & Johnson, a senior Asia rep, about their proposal, and they are working with a major US health agency at the moment. They believe they could scale up, were they to be successful, to deliver up to a billion doses in the emergency phase of the pandemic, and to do so at cost. Now, this again comes into the problem. Who is it who first discovers or develops a workable vaccine? And then who is it that produces it? And then who is it that distributes it? To whom?
Well, we have a good system for doing that at the moment for the developed world, which is a commercial one, and for the developing world, some agencies such as Gavi working with the commercial companies. But this will certainly challenge that system, because the need for a vaccine will be immediate and the rate of distribution of doses is going to be much higher than any vaccine that we currently use.
How could that cooperation happen? As I said, perhaps Oxford is first to develop the vaccine. Johnson & Johnson argues it has the facilities to produce it and to scale up. How could we coordinate the strengths of the different parts of a very disparate system?
Well, we do have two agencies that are responsible for delivering vaccines to children, Gavi for the developing world and also UNICEF. And we do have the opportunity to make use of the World Health Organization as an organization, a vehicle for administering that. But yes, it's going to be a challenge. And now is the time to start addressing that so that we're ready when we do have a vaccine for getting it out there. I mean, what we really wouldn't want would be to have a vaccine and not have thought through the question that you've just asked.
Do you see signs from any of the international peers that you have or organisations that you liaise with that that leadership is happening?
Look, I think that the leadership is there in several places, but obviously bringing everybody together in one spot will be easier once we understand exactly what the vaccine will be like and exactly how we're going to use it. I think the important thing is that we're talking about these issues already, and that will give us the best chance of being ready when the vaccine becomes available.
I'm conscious I need to let you go in a moment, but what else do we need to consider when we start planning our lives and our economies around a vaccine? For example, how long might we anticipate any successful vaccine is effective?
Well, look, I think, first of all, it's very important to understand that despite all the good stories to date, we might never have a vaccine. As I say, we've been trying for vaccines for coronavirus for a long time and haven't yet got one that's out there. But so we don't want to put all of our eggs in the basket of a vaccine. We want to also look for possible treatments for people who are already infected. And we want to realise that we may not get either of these. But assuming that we can get a vaccine that will work, then the critical thing in all of that is to make sure that there is an understanding that this isn't a vaccine for Australia, for New Zealand, for any particular country. It's a global vaccine to control a global pandemic.
My very last question before I let you go is there value in New Zealand cooperating or trying to become involved with whatever is happening in Australia? I've spoken to Ziro about the work they are doing there, the stage they are at. Is there a logic and a capacity for a trans-Tasman approach to this, even in the production of a vaccine?
Look, it's very important that anybody and everybody who has skills and the ability to make, manufacture, test vaccines gets involved in the game. Many hands make light work, and Australia and New Zealand have been partners in many things in the past, and it would seem logical that we might partner in this area again in the future. So yes, I think it's important that New Zealand plays its part in the global effort and that partnerships are encouraged. Make sure that you make use of all the home talent that you have to help them to get vaccines for this particular infection. It might even be that the successful vaccine will be developed by a New Zealand scientist.
Thank you so much for your time. I know it's tight. Thank you. Ian Fraser from the University of Queensland, who co-developed the HPV vaccine Gardasil. It's 20 minutes past nine. You're listening to Nine to Noon. Well, listening into that, our guests now, two guests next, University of Otago Infectious Disease Specialist Professor David Murdoch. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Good morning also to Professor Graham LeGros, who heads the biomedical research at the Maligan Institute and says relying on other countries for a vaccine would be the wrong approach. He is working on a Kiwi-made vaccine. Graham, I'll get you to pick up first on any points out of what Ian Fraser had to say.
Yeah, well, thank you. Good morning, everyone, and morning, David. Ian actually basically said it all, and I think laid it out, just to emphasise a couple of things. We're actually in a privileged position in New Zealand that we can actually learn from some of the vaccine developments occurring elsewhere, some of the strengths and weaknesses and where some of the barriers will be to introducing a true global rollout. And I make the statement that late to start, but first to finish. And I really liked Ian Fraser's last statement. Maybe a vaccine will come out of New Zealand, but we're learning a lot from, because there's a global cooperation amongst the scientific community. We really are every day. We're all Zooming each other and really trying to understand things. In terms of picking up what Ian said, I think we have a responsibility to the Pacific. We have a responsibility to ensuring that the voice, our louder voice, makes sure that people aren't forgotten in this vaccine development, because all our economies, the Pacific people as well, very dependent on actually having a way of moving and transporting things, people, tourism, etc. So we've really got to think about our responsibility there.
As you pointed out... go ahead.
Ian talked about vaccination of healthy volunteers. One of the other things we don't know is what about people who are slightly immune compromised, all that sort of stuff. Vaccines take a long time because all the bits and pieces of a population need to be sorted out. Who's at risk from vaccine side effects? Who's not at risk? These normally take 10 years to get sorted out because they're long, deep, difficult problems. And just rolling out a vaccine to some healthy volunteers, that works for them, but we also have to be very mindful. We have to do a lot of research to find out what can go wrong and what are the issues for those less well patients who are actually pretty perfectly fine, but we don't want to make a vaccine making them sicker.
Graham, what you could do, though, I dread to bring up the words herd effect, but a herd effect is normally achieved through vaccination, and could that be a staged approach?
Yes, we'll have to have good controls, and we have learnt actually how to do that a bit with population controls and the social distancing or physical distance, yes, but we need to be actually a very well-organised population to do that, and the government will have to have systems in place to roll it out, say, with primary healthcare workers, first of all, the most exposed, most vulnerable people, etc., tourists if they want to come to New Zealand, or if people that need to leave New Zealand go somewhere else for their jobs and stuff like that, we'd actually be able to do that, you're right. It would take quite a lot of coordination.
You've pointed out in your New Zealand Medical Association piece, along with others, including James Usher, that how high the stakes are. The economic cost of maintaining the current border restrictions will be in excess of $22 billion per year, $63 million every day. And it's clear that, and everyone is hanging hopes on this vaccine arriving. However, what do we need to get real about, including being in the queue when it is able to come to market? What are your fears?
Well, our fears are if we just sit on our hands like ducks, nothing will happen, and all of a sudden all we'll have to offer the rest of the world is money, and we will have to pay. And also, we don't have the same amount of money as, say, many of these other larger economies. We will not get access to that vaccine. And we are fearful about money will be the decider. So we feel we've got to use our skills and strengths in the science networks. We actually have true globally recognized production capacity for vaccine development. We make great animal vaccines. We can actually turn that to making great human vaccines. We used to make human vaccines, vaccinia, for instance, in the 1970s. So surely with our rather privileged position, our rather privileged education in science and technology, we just need to put shoulders to the wheel there. We firmly believe that.
The challenge to producing here may well be patents. We're going to talk more to George Laking about this. Johnson & Johnson talking to them again about their offer to produce at cost up to $1 billion in the emergency phase, or the current phase of the pandemic, and to do so at cost. That's putting a lot on Johnson & Johnson being the ones to have the vaccine ready to go. Whomever it is, again, is our challenge going to be the current systems for procurement? What do they look like? Do you want to pick up on that, David?
Well, absolutely. I think the concern is very clearly we are in a position we've never been in before, with the whole world seeking quick access to a new vaccine. So we are all adjusting to this and wondering how we're going to how this is going to be managed. So you're absolutely right. There are issues around the licensing, the issues around IP. I mean, it is very, very complex. I think the key thing from New Zealand's perspective is we actually have a national strategy, and whether that strategy involves the manufacture or development or just how we procure it, but we do need to have a strategy. And I disagree. I agree totally with Graham about the Pacific. I mean, that's often forgotten, but we have a responsibility there as well. So I totally agree and would emphasise that point.
Well, you've got this experience working in vaccine evaluation and deployment. You were on the National Farm Act Committee for about 10 years, also worked at country level in Nepal. How would it look here at the moment? As we understand it, it wouldn't be Farm Act going out to buy this vaccine. What do you anticipate any procurement strategy looking like?
Well, I agree totally with Ian about we need the global effort. I don't think this is going to you know, that's first and foremost. And I'm sure there's a lot happening at the moment, and we obviously need to plug into that. And the likes of the Gavi Alliance and WHO and UNICEF are obviously very key players in that, as are some of the funders. And so there is a Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, which is behind a lot of the funding. And certainly there were issues. I understand that their support requires equity plans from those they fund right from the beginning. The major focus is on getting to the low-income countries, which has been a major focus in vaccine development for quite a while. And so there are some systems in place. Of course, we're a rich country, and we're a small rich country in the Southern Hemisphere with responsibility over quite a few middle-income countries in the South Pacific. So it is a legitimate concern that we certainly will not be a high priority, but we need to be in the game, obviously, in terms of how we get access at the right time.
Well, who leads, if not Pharmac? Is it the Ministry of Health with everything it's doing at the moment? Is it MBIE? Is it MFAT? Because these involve negotiations, trade negotiations potentially, or international multilateral negotiations. Who's going to lead?
Well, it will certainly involve all those players. I think you're absolutely right. And where that lead comes from, whether it's MBIE or the ministry, I think that it needs to be clarified. But there needs to be, you know, clearly someone taking the lead on that and to develop, get the right sort of advice from all around the world within New Zealand and beyond to develop that strategy in the right way.
Graham, what do you think a national strategy should look like? Are you seeing anything that resembles one?
Well, yes, I think it's growing. I think, and it's great to have David on board with his experience. I think the strategy right now should be flexibility, and I think emphasise that. Ian said that too. We actually don't know what a successful vaccine looks like, so I think we can be in a really good situation as long as we develop flexible platforms, flexible approaches, because we just don't know what it's going to look like. And even Ian at the end, he talked about, well, what happens if the vaccine doesn't quite work and we need a different kind of immune stimulus, something like the BCG, just to that actually gives us enough protection. It may be that it's hard to get proper protective immunity against this virus in the lungs. So we have to be prepared for that as well. So I think having some real flexibility as to what the solutions can look like. And I think Bill Gates said it so well. He said, look, I'm going to put, you know, $1 billion on several different types of vaccine production. One of them won't ever be used. But, hey, $1 billion, it doesn't matter as long as we have it ready in time for when the successful candidate comes out. And I think this is such a global issue. It's such a critical issue to New Zealand's survival. We can afford as a country to actually have a bit of preparedness across a couple of different platforms and engage at a number of levels, at political, government, but also don't underestimate the scientists. We get used to the idea that we're going to set up a ministry and blah, blah. They've only got so many interactions. We're deeply plugged into the American NIH, NIAID through our scientific contacts. We're deeply plugged into Oxford, where the vaccines come from. We're deeply plugged into Australia. Let's use our all levels of our international relationships to get access, to provide solutions. We can do preclinical studies that they can't do in this anywhere in the world. I vouch for the fact my particular assay is looking at cytokine storms and stuff. No one else in the world's got them, and we can test vaccines. So I'm very confident.
Let's cut to the chase. You have got some big political players who could just go, we're first. And actually, at the moment, their behaviour is demonstrating we're first. We have, as Ian Fraser raised early, an obligation to countries with minimal health systems compared to ours and incredibly vulnerable populations, their rights to get this. So that brings us back to New Zealand, which, if it is successful in eliminating, is perhaps staring at the long border closure in the absence of a treatment or access to a vaccine, having to deal with two very stark realities. What are the prospects, if patent and other matters could somehow be resolved, of producing what we need here, Graham? Could we tap in somehow that way, and or with Australia?
Let's not be vague. We can do it. I just want to say that. Let's stop being shilly-shagged. We can do it. Of course we can. We've made vaccines. There's no reason why we can't make something like a protein vaccine and put it into people and test it. We've got some of the best clinicians in the world. David will back me up there. We can do it.
David?
I believe we have. We've got absolutely fantastic scientists and clinicians in this country, and I guess just the reality of whether we can do it in the time frame we need, I don't know. I think the key thing, I think, is we need to explore it. We actually need to have, as I say, the national strategy. We tend to have this habit in New Zealand of having these gaps that are often filled by scientists and do a great job, but actually what we need is to have the leadership in that as well and the direction, which is possibly what I'm not quite seeing at the moment. I think it's coming, but certainly there we have the other pieces in it, but we need to explore what is possible with its manufacturing or developing or how we can access better what has been produced elsewhere.
If we get a best case, say, and that vaccine is being produced in 12 to 18 months' time, how long does it take not only to scale up, and I gave you Johnson & Johnson's belief they've got the biggest and best capacity to scale up quickly, not only to scale up production, but distribution. I thought I read amongst a million articles recently, it could take up to a year to distribute around the world. David, what's the reality?
Well, yes, I mean, I can't comment on those data. I guess what I can say is I've been constantly surprised by the vaccine world over time and the ability. I mean, we've never had this situation, never this scale. But it would be interesting just to see what can happen with all the vaccine manufacturers, and not just from the rich countries in the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, there are, India and Brazil and other countries are also major manufacturers. So I think I'm waiting, really just seeing what will happen. And nothing will surprise me, I think, in terms of that scalability. But I can't really comment further.
If there were, David, to be a global strategy over production and distribution, and it may well involve putting aside a patent, more with George in a moment, putting aside a patent and accepting that this is a genuine global social need, who would lead it? Who in the fractured politics we have right now, with the United States withholding funding from the biggest multilateral health organisation, who would lead it?
Yes, it's a good question. What we've seen, I guess what we can look back and what has happened with other situations, and it's often been entities with major philanthropic funding and often with countries who have a very philanthropic mindset. So the Gavi Alliance would be one of those, the Global Alliance on Vaccines and Immunizations, which was set up under that basis. And I have no doubt those sort of players will have will hopefully have a key role. At least there is a semblance of being values driven. But I think we will need to see what will shape up. And certainly a lot of those players are starting to make a bit of noise. So we may see something built along similar ground. But I think none of us underestimate the problems and the complexity here.
Or actually, conversely, the shortness of time, not for finding the vaccine, but for sorting the global politics, commercial and otherwise. Thank you both very much, David Murdoch, Graham Legros. And listening in, and thank you for it, is Dr. George Laking. Doctors are adding their concerns about COVID-19 vaccine availability if one is developed. Two open letters signed by international and health national organisations have been sent to the Minister of Health and Minister of Trade, urging them to address concerns that WTO intellectual property trade rules could prevent our ability to secure affordable access to medical supplies, including vaccines and potential medicines to treat COVID-19. Dr. George Laking is a medical oncologist from Doctors for Healthy Trade and is with us. George, welcome. Thanks very much for your time.
Kia ora, Catherine.
What are your concerns?
Well, Doctors for Healthy Trade has been concerned for some time about the uneven structuring of trade agreements, really to favour the profitability of the pharmaceutical industry. as against need for people's access to medicines. There's limited access of civil society voices to be involved in trade agreements. But that's really been the motivation for us to speak up on this. But the acute topic that came to light was part of the TRIPS agreement that the World Trade Organization has, trade-related aspects of intellectual property, and perhaps a sort of seemingly obscure part of that called Article 31 bis, which relates to a situation where a country creates a compulsory licensing arrangement to manufacture a medicine, so bypassing the usual intellectual property protections that TRIPS guarantees. And that, I think, has been envisaged sometimes in situations of extreme demand or emergency even. A less well-off country may elect to set aside the usual IP protections that exist and require that a medicine be compulsory licensed for manufacture in that country. So then the question is, well, okay, a country starts making a medicine under a compulsory license. Should they then be able to trade that medicine around the world and further work against IP protection? And so for nations that have generally supported the framework of IP protections, including New Zealand, essentially New Zealand, amongst certain other nations, has said, well, if another country compulsorily licenses a medicine, we won't buy it ever under any circumstances. We won't buy into that. And that's the information that we became aware of at Doctors for Healthy Trade. And just considering that in the context of the extreme demand on supply chains that we're starting to see around the world with the current crisis, for example, personal protective equipment, certain medicines like hydroxychloroquine have become very hard to obtain. This raises the possibility that effective medicines may be developed for COVID-19, but New Zealand, as a smaller country, without a manufacturing capability of its own, ends up at the end of the queue.
Okay.
New Zealand is all familiar with queuing for things nowadays.
Yeah. So, George, if I could just, I just want to clarify. Yeah. The compulsory license suspends the monopoly effect of a patent, all right, and it allows others other than the patent holder to produce and supply. Now, several countries have already started using these. I think I saw Ecuador has, there's certainly been a request to the health minister in Ecuador to use compulsory licensing. The Parliament of Chile has adopted such a resolution. And interestingly, one major drug company has changed its position and eased its patent. It's argued to avoid having its compulsory license put across it. New Zealand, of course, is a big trading nation. It's a big fan of the WTO. It sees it as a protective multilateral organisation that, if anything, is under threat at the moment. What are you saying? If we need to do this, need to use this process in order to access the vaccine, then we should.
Yeah, I think most people in New Zealand would agree with that. If we're really on the brink of catastrophe and there's a medicine available on the market and we can't locate the medicine anywhere else, we ought to be able to buy that one.
Yet another thing that a strategy would have to consider. And do you have concerns also about whether Big Pharma, the big companies, and several of them are involved in the race for vaccine development, will become part of a genuine global cooperation?
Well, there's an interesting dance of public opinion and I guess social license to operate that Big Pharma is also part of. But in general, they've got a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. They have interests and profitability. So this type of move is always going to be pushing against the general thread of pharma being profitable.
There's so much to unfold. George, thanks very much for your contribution too. Dr. George Lakin, who is a medical oncologist, also with Doctors for Healthy Trade. It is 18 minutes to 10. Of course, we asked the Ministry of Health and we've asked the Minister of Health to come on and talk about what the strategy is that's being developed to make sure New Zealand does not end at the back of the queue for a vaccine or is simply able not to access one in a timely way. The latest statement we have is the development of a safe and effective vaccine is a crucial tool in the eradication of COVID-19 worldwide. The government is currently investigating how to ensure research efforts here connect to global research, so there is a coordinated strategy on finding a vaccine. More information will be available on this soon. New Zealand is currently developing a vaccine strategy that will bring together key players in a coordinated approach. The vaccine strategy will form part of a broader immunisation strategy. It has named the various agencies who are going to be involved in designing this. MedSafe, Pharmac, Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment and others. And there is no more detail available. We would enjoy an interview as progress allows and sooner rather than later be much appreciated.